I'm Steve Chaney. I'm the CEO of the American Security Project. And for those not familiar with ASP, we're a 501c3 nonprofit established in 2006 by Senators Kerry, Hart, Hagel, and Rudman. And the intent behind ASP was to take on topical issues that perhaps got slanted one way or the other, and that we would educate folks on these issues. And we've got a number of them that we're big into: energy security, climate change, nuclear security, to name a few. And lately, we have branched into public diplomacy with Matthew Wallen, who's our fellow on public diplomacy. So it's kind of a new area for us, but we think a particularly important one. When you look back on my board, it's been a tumultuous couple of weeks for us, losing both Kerry and Hagel, but they're in pretty good spots to support us and the work that we do. And indeed, if you look back at our website and see what they've signed up to, you can get kind of an idea of some of the things that are going to be on both their agendas at state and defense. But that's not why we're here today, and I kind of like the topic that Matthew laid out here, improving relations on Earth by exploring space. You need to go to Capitol Hill and we can fix them up there. We're trying hard. And we got two very distinguished guests. Matthew's going to introduce them here in a minute. We're appreciative that you both came. Familiar with NASA, of course, and your association as well, Vaughn. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Matthew Wallen, who's our fellow for public diplomacy.
Thank you, Steve. Glad to see everyone here. It's a unique subject that we're approaching here at ASP, and one that's relatively new for us. Public diplomacy for ASP is something that we view as a national security issue. It's primarily about influencing audiences overseas and building relationships with those audiences. It's about the American message, which is carried out not only in narrative, but in actions as well. And the things that NASA and our scientists do are a primary example of that. The proper use of public diplomacy allows the U.S. to better craft policy and achieve its foreign policy objectives by establishing and maintaining these trust relationships overseas. Sometimes they're with allies, sometimes they're with nations that we're slightly less friendly with. But while the U.S. has had notable difficulties in influencing certain foreign audiences, it has maintained certain advantages over the years. Polling and research studies in recent years have continuously seen science and technology ranked as one of America's greatest assets. It's really about soft power, that is, the power to attract rather than to coerce. At the forefront of these American scientific efforts, we often find NASA. But while landing on the moon and teaching the world more about itself through projects like the Hubble Space Telescope over the years are inspiring, NASA has also been a leader in diplomatic efforts overseas. So we have two guests here today. On my right, we have Kent G. Bress. Kent is the director of the Aeronautics and Cross-Agency Support Division at the Office of International Interagency Relations at NASA headquarters in D.C. He served in that office since 1993 and has been a division director since 2007. In his current position, he oversees NASA's collaboration with Europe and Canada and supervises the negotiation of international agreements in the areas of aeronautics, space technology, education, and public outreach. From 1997 to 1999, he was NASA's representative in Moscow, Russia. On my far right is Dr. Von Tarikian. He is the Chief International Officer for the American Association for the Advancement of Science, right next door. He's also the Director of AAAS's Center for Science and Diplomacy and the Editor-in-Chief of Science and Diplomacy Magazine, a quarterly publication of the Center for SAT. Dr. Tarikian has served as Special Assistant to the Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs, where he was a lead advisor on international science, technology, environment and health issues, including clean energy, sustainable development, climate change, which is an area ASP focuses in specifically, as well as scientific outreach and avian flu. He's a two-time recipient of the Department Superior Honor Award for his work on climate change and avian flu. And with that, I'd like to start with Dr. Tarikian.
Well, thank you, Matt. Thank you, Steve, for hosting us here today. And it's a pleasure to get an opportunity to chat a little bit, and I'll give sort of the broad overview of science diplomacy, the way that we think about it, but really it's interesting when we think about mixing science diplomacy and public diplomacy, because I think that we have to think about it both in terms of what it can do, but also a little bit carefully. So I read a lot of these same polling data that everyone looked at and saw other people saying, look, there are parts of the world where people just don't like the United States. But in every one of those places, the respect and admiration for U.S. science remains extremely high. And, you know, if you want, I'm losing the big mics. It's okay. Story of my life. But what ends up happening oftentimes is that we look at those statistics and we say, you know what that means? Man, if we just throw more science at things, people are going to like us better. Kind of, but not really. And that's where we have to be a little bit careful when we think about science diplomacy. Science diplomacy fundamentally starts with the science. Fundamentally, for us to use, the U.S. to use science as a way to attract, to do other things, requires that the science that we put behind it, things that NASA does, many of our agencies, most of our universities, lots of our institutes do, are fundamentally underpinned by the best science, a well-funded scientific regime that's always served as the way to bring people in and to really get access to the top talent. One need only look around this room to see the diversity in the United States in terms of people interested in issues around science and technology. And it's growing more and more. The caveat I'll make about science diplomacy, though, is that while it has a link to public diplomacy, it shouldn't be viewed as the panacea. That if you go to places where people don't like the United States or don't like US policy, that if you put more science at the problem, people are going to suddenly switch their views. No, what ends up happening actually in reality is people, whether they're in the United States or anywhere or any topic, do a very good job of differentiating and categorizing and cataloging their different pieces. What we think about more and more is this issue that I think about with somebody like learning golf. I'm not a golfer. But if I were to learn golf, somebody were to say to me, what do you think about Tiger Woods as a person? And I'd say, I don't know, he seems sort of like a jerk, right? But somebody said to me, whom do you want to learn golf from? I'd say, I'd love to learn from Tiger Woods. He's the best there is. That is not totally different from the way in which a lot of the world thinks about the United States vis-a-vis science. When people look at the United States with science, they go, I might not like everything about it. I might have differences in all their different opinions of, you know, what they should do in terms of governments and other things. But man, when I look at their science, they're the best in the world. And that's who I want to model myself on. That actually has a much longer term impact on the way that the United States is able to engage with the world. Because what that does is it actually attracts people to our universities and our institutes and all the places I mentioned before to learn the scientific method, to learn things that we take for granted, that the lingua franca of the world is actually English, because the top people around the world, and the top educated people, are actually speaking English. Top leadership is speaking English, because many, if not most of them, have actually spent some time in the United States. There's great advantages to the conduct of U.S. foreign policy, because science has been an attractor. Again, it starts with, the fact that scientific expertise is really sort of considered paramount and one of the best. What's happening now, and it's changing, and it'll be interesting to hear sort of a NASA perspective on this as well, is that, and you actually see it with things like China launching more things to the moon and other things, that lead may be eroding a little bit for lots of reasons, or other countries are also placing great emphasis on science. So what happened is, for a very long period of time, the U.S. was the filter feeder. It got the best science coming into it, the best scientists, and always had access to it. Now, as more and more nodes of science are being set up around the world, to get access to that science, we have to be a little bit more of a predator, which means we have to do a better job of reaching out to those places overseas where great science is taking place. And that means, just by definition, an internationalization of almost everything that the scientific enterprise does. The result is actually that the U.S. then has great access and great opportunities, but also has to deal with the things that now deal with the conduct of science. And this is where science diplomacy and public diplomacy are so important. We, through being excellent in science and admired in science, have written many of the rules of the scientific enterprise. The way of peer review, transparency, meritocracy, all things that actually are really, really important, not only to science, but the way in which societies function. So we've benefited, and now we're going to get more benefit from the fact that many of the top world leaders in science have been trained in the United States. And as we now reach out, we are again speaking not only common language, but we're also doing it from the standpoint of a common set of values and approaches. So I think with that, I'm going to end, because I think, you know, we'll leave more time for questions at the end. But
thanks
very much. Go ahead.
Well, that was an absolutely great introduction, because you touched on a lot of the same things that something I had meant to bring up at some point during my, discussion here. And the fact that, you know, in a way which what you've said has allowed me to say a little bit more easily an explanation for why it is that NASA maybe didn't go out with the intention to perform public diplomacy, but in the end we wound up doing it. And it's because of what you said, it starts with the science. It starts with being the best, right? So NASA, as you'll see, is all about the mission. It's all about human space flight, space science, earth science, aeronautics, space technology. And we strive to be the very best at these things. And by that, we bring partners to us. And in that process, over the years, you start establishing a lingua franca, not just English, but also exactly what Bonnie just talked about. The shared values that we have with scientists around the world on things like peer review and transparency, even down to the processes that we go through for our missions. You know, we'll walk into a new partnership with a country like India and find that when they explain their engineering processes to us, we're looking at our own processes because they have been with us in our institutes and research agencies for a long time, and we've just sort of set that. So that's a really unique way that you can achieve soft power and achieve public diplomacy. And if you ask the people who are doing it, they wouldn't. They'd be like me. They'd have to go back to Wikipedia and look up the meaning of the words. So with that, let me just, since you've got a person from NASA here, let me just spend 5 minutes talking about what NASA priorities are. We are a government agency, of course. We're funded currently at around $17 billion. And our main missions are the things I just mentioned, human space flight, space science, earth science, aeronautics, space technology development. Right now, if someone were to ask me what our top priorities were, I wouldn't have to guess because I've been told that they are the development of a new rocket, a heavy lift launch vehicle called the Space Launch System, the development of a spacecraft called the Multipurpose Crew Vehicle, or Orion. By the way, my son's named Orion, but we have the name first, right? So both parents are NASA geeks, so that happens. And so these new spacecraft, we're also operating the International Space Station, and part of that is developing a new generation of vehicles to take cargo and crew to the space station. And you just saw, we had a bit of a nail biter over the weekend, but SpaceX, a company, private company, succeeded in taking a spacecraft up to the station, which is there now. And then the other thing that's a main priority for us is the completion of the James Webb Space Telescope. You know, in an agency that's got 93 space missions in some stage from formulation to end of life, and has got multiple programs in other fields, you got to have priorities, and those are ours right now. At the same time, we're doing a lot of other stuff too. We're focusing on, now that we've built the International Space Station, we're focusing on getting some scientific use out of it. We're working to better understand and protect our planet through multiple, I think the last time I counted there were 18 that still are operating Earth science missions. We are trying to characterize the threat to Earth, the asteroids, might pose. We're continuing to explore Mars, and we are exploring the solar system and beyond with new missions, including a mission to an asteroid. So it's an extremely cool time to be working at NASA. I've been there since 1990, and every day is fascinating. So with that, let me move on. Next slide. Okay. Since I've been asked to talk about NASA and public diplomacy, not just our international cooperation, the presentation that I've put together is going to be a little bit different from any of the ones that I've done before, than the ones we typically give to our industry partners or foreign partners. It's not one that actually has been approved by my boss, so if no one sees the YouTube on this, don't go tell him, right? But I'm winging it a little bit. Talking about public diplomacy is a bit of a new thing for a bureaucrat and a technical agency like me. And so one thing that I'm looking forward to from Matt, from the audience, is I would appreciate your feedback and input in helping us think of new ways to think about public diplomacy. I'm going to leave you with a couple of points, and one of which is something that I think Vaughn and I derived from what Vaughn said, is that the conduct of public diplomacy by a technical agency sometimes is intentional and can also be unintentional. The other takeaway that I wanted to leave is that there are multiple sort of levels of through which public diplomacy is being exerted through NASA. And not all of them involve international cooperation into what we would call traditional sense. But to start with, if you could hit the next slide, please. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on comfortable ground, and then I'll try to go into a little bit about the various levels of public diplomacy. So, as I mentioned before, I was kind of joking about Wikipedia, but not really. My office, I work for the Office of International and Interagency Relations at NASA headquarters. And international relations at NASA is a corporate function, which is to say that even though we have 10 field centers that are scattered around the country, the policies for international cooperation are set and maintained at headquarters. And our office sort of oversees all that. And so the things that we wind up doing when you're in the grand scheme of public diplomacy may seem rather mundane. We write the agreements that describe cooperation. We, when senior officials go overseas or when they receive their counterparts from foreign countries, we're the ones who staff the meetings and prepare all the meeting notes and make sure that the coffee is hot and everything else. And then we provide guidance on actual foreign policy, the external conditions, sort of the limits within which our cooperation can take place. We help to inform, educate, interpret, provide guidance on those policies to people in the field centers, the technical scientists and engineers who are actually carrying out our cooperation. We're not really, what I'm trying to say is that we're not diplomats, and we're not really the outreach people, although they're the ones who made sure that I mentioned all those things that Tess is doing at the beginning of the conversation. So we do talk sometimes. The topic of public diplomacy, though, is something we don't usually deal with in my office, and so I was sent to look up the definitions. So, and I believe, so you can see behind. I understand that there's been a sort of a transition to maybe a broader understanding of what the concept means. And the one that I found sort of spoke to me a little bit was the one from Jill Shuker, who defines it as effectively communicating with publics around the world to understand, value, and even emulate Americans' visions and ideas. The idea of coming to share common values, especially in the scientific area, I think is critically important. And we won't talk about that, but I think what Vaughn said totally nailed it again. It starts with the science. So, next question. So NASA was created in 1958, you know, for a variety of reasons, but primarily it was created to meet the challenge of the Soviet Union. So in a way, it was foreign policy right from the get-go. And the values that sort of define NASA are written right down in the Space Act that created us in 1958. And they reflect kind of a mix of values that range from both the lofty to the more mundane. And by lofty, I mean, here's a government agency that is being charged with reaching for the stars, you know, and from right from the beginning saying, what NASA learns about the universe will be shared with all mankind. So that's lofty ideals. What it created, though, was a scientific research technology development government agency. By the way, I think that might be a conceit, but I think this idea that this agency must go out and share everything that it learns about the universe with the public may be uniquely American, and it may reflect, you know, as NASA was a country at the height of its power, you know, confident and self-assured. So, and that's the sort of governing ideas that were set down in the Space Act are the things that result in the cooperation that we now have. I'll mention a couple things about what's on the slide. So over our history, since 1958, we've concluded more than 4,000 international agreements with foreign partners. We currently have about 600 of them active at the moment. And the way they're distributed sort of reflects the, kind of what you might think. Our major partners are the major industrial countries that have developed early on their own space programs. You may not know that most of our cooperation is in the area of space science and earth science. Relatively little, but there's still significant amount is done in aeronautics. And of course, aeronautics, by its nature, is involved where And half of our partners are with you. That is to say, the other half are not. So the other half are with other than our so-called traditional partners. So I'll get into that in just a second. Get to the next one. So, like I said before, this is comfortable ground for me because this is how we do international cooperation. This, what's on the screen right now, you might consider it to be the strategy, at least from our office, which, like I said, is the corporate manager for international relations at headquarters. And it's these points are done to, basically they're done to ensure our institutional values, which are to implement policy that is policies, international policies that really are formed by others, for example, by the State Department, by our administration. They're about making sure that everyone knows and abides by U.S. laws and regulations. We are set to help our mission directorates carry out their missions and to provide oversight and guidance for international cooperation, but in ways that make sure that they do so within acceptable parameters. The need to have clear managerial and technical interfaces. We have found through long experience that international cooperation can be highly complicated, and that if you bring your partners too much into the design process, and if there's ambiguity about who's in charge of any particular part of the mission, that only increases the cost and complexity of what's inherently complicated. Right? So I guess what I'm trying to impart by showing you these rules, basically, is that this is how we have traditionally done cooperation. No exchange of funds, consistent with U.S. law. Our partners are generally government agencies or their research institutes that are funded by government agencies. All of our cooperation, all 600 activities, has to be shown to have a benefit for NASA missions. And they are all done with appropriate coordination with other government agencies, including the State Department. But I do want to go beyond those charts just a little bit. In the couple of days that I've been thinking about public diplomacy, it comes to me that there are perhaps public diplomacy at NASA can be thought of as sort of as three sort of Venn diagrams that can be superimposed on each other. There is the sort of intentional, high level and formal decisions by the administration and national foreign policy to inform our what NASA does. So for example, like I said, the very formation of NASA itself was a political, a foreign political act to meet the challenge of the Soviet Union. There are guidelines that we must abide by that are set for us as a matter of national policy. And then there is, that's one thing. Second thing is the realm in which people in my office spend most of their time. And that is helping NASA conduct bilateral or multilateral coordination space missions with partners who, in many respects, are like us. And we do this through the formation of formal intergovernmental agreements that have to abide by all those rules. And it's something that we've proven been very successful at over the years. And it's resulted in, so I'll give you examples. It's resulted in some pretty cool stuff. But then there's the third thing, which is sort of the more organic level. And diplomacy, again, that's some intended, some not. And it's reaching out to different publics, right? There is the public that consists of the expert community, you know, scientists around the world, engineers who help their policymakers in their country make important regulatory decisions about important matters, I think, in terms of things like the ITU. Students, educators from around the country, or from other countries, and then there's the general public. And to bring social media into this, we're now at a kind of a really interesting time, and NASA has been pretty good, I think, at taking advantage of the new opportunities afforded by social media to push out our message even more broadly. So that's kind of my thesis, that there are multiple levels from which public diplomacy arises, so through which NASA serves public diplomacy. Next please. So the first, and I'm trying to go from perhaps the most formal to the most informal. There's the sort of traditional government-to-government collaboration, where NASA cooperates on missions with other partners who are primarily funded by governments. work, you mentioned, for example, the null site use test program. Here is an example of a case where the United States decided to partner with its main adversary, the Soviet Union. And in fact, even before that was done in 1975, NASA had established a record of technical collaboration with scientists in the Soviet Union going back to 1968. We started off slow, and we started in very much in coordination with other government agencies. But we started working on space life sciences. We were the only two countries out there that were flying people in space. And so we began to have exchanges of scientists and engineers. And that blossomed, actually, into the Apollo-Soyuz test project in 1975. While that was a matter of high policy, and was eventually curtailed, it moves toward more cooperation in space were curtailed, especially after the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. But what it did was also create a apparently temporary, but in fact long-lasting commonality of purpose, of mutual understanding, I guess I want to say, between scientists and engineers who had worked on those programs together. So that by the early 1990s, when the Soviet Union had collapsed and the US and Russia were looking for ways that we could begin to start working together again, the individuals who had taken part in the Apollo-Soyuz test project, they were still working at an air gear in Russia, or Lavochka, or the Space Flight Center, or in their Khrunichev, the big design bureaus. They were still working at the Johnson Space Center. And so they were beginning, and they recalled their collaboration. They recalled building the docking module together. And so that was able to get us to a point where quickly, within a short amount of time, we were able to mount the Shuttle Mir program. From that, the next year or so later, another political decision was made to involve the Russians in what is the world's largest science and technology undertaking, construction of the International Space Station. So the message that I'm trying to convey here is that decisions taken for primarily political reasons can lead to the development of mutual understanding and awareness of common approaches among people that last for generations. So not to take up too much time, but let me take another approach to this idea too. So we're at a fun time in NASA right now because we're in NASA International Relations, because we're coming up on a series of 50th anniversaries with all of our major partners. NASA's cooperation started out not accidentally with our strategic partners. So a couple years ago, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the first launch of the Canadian satellite, which was done in cooperation with the U.S. Last year, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the U.S.-French Telstar satellite, which was done in cooperation between France and the U.S. This year, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary, next year too, of an agreement with Italy for launching a satellite from the San Marco research platform in Italy and the Red Sea. So all of these things NASA did, it's no accident that our first partners were strategic partners. While the Apollo program was going on, our focus was on, Apollo programs, our focus was certainly on human space flight, but we were doing all these other things too that set us down a course for cooperation with our major partners for the next 50 years. Now, at the same time that we were collaborating intentionally with our major strategic partners, something funny happened. When you build a Gemini program, or the Mercury Gemini Apollo program, we needed to communicate with the spacecraft, and we couldn't do it except by building ground stations around the world. So NASA had a presence in Zanzibar. We had a presence on the Canton Island. We had a presence in Nigeria, all in the early 60s. So I can't actually attest personally to the effect that this had on the local scientific people and the local science establishment there. But I do know that it was an opportunity for us to get out to the people and what NASA does around the world that we could not have done otherwise. Next, please. So let me give you just a couple examples of what we do now for international cooperation. So cooperation from here, I'm moving now from the sort of the nationally directed, big outreach, working with our strategic partners, confronting the challenge of the Soviet Union. Here I'm moving more into the bread and butter of my daily life. So the 600 agreements that we have primarily offer things like the International Space Station, a massive multilateral undertaking, 15 countries, 5 space agencies. We've flown 63 astronauts from 15 countries on 87 shuttle missions. All of this requires day-to-day management of our international partnerships. Probably the most typical kind of international cooperation we have is in science, where we and our partners exchange things like instruments that are flown on each other's missions. The science mission director at NASA headquarters currently has about 93 missions in one stage or another, either from just beginning to think about building them to figuring out how we're going to bring them down from orbit. And international cooperation is a part of 2/3 of those activities. And it involves things like you see up there, the Mars Curiosity rover, which just landed during the 7 minutes dinner. That has many, many pieces that we contributed by our partners. I guess a thing that I should mention too is that behind every one of these instruments is a small army of scientists and researchers who are making their careers based on the reason the science that's coming off of these things. Next, please. So the first thing those two examples there involved our traditional partners, but the fact is we also collaborate with a growing set of countries that are steadily increasing their capability to work in space. And India, probably for us, is the most interesting of these from my personal perspective. A couple of years ago, we collaborated with the Indians on their very first lunar mission by providing two of the 7 or 8 instruments that they had on that mission. But it's not just countries like India, it's also Argentina. We have established a pattern of collaborating with Argentina by providing them instruments for spacecraft that they develop and are launched in the United States. And it also includes human spaceflight. Now, we've flown astronauts, the space shuttle, from 4 different countries, from Mexico, Saudi Arabia, Ukraine, and Israel. And there's an interesting question here, because it's no accident that we have flown astronauts in which the U.S. government from countries with which the U.S. government has had an interest in improving its relations. That kind of thing doesn't happen without input from above. You don't get, for example, an invitation, the permission to invite the Russians to the International Space Station without suggestions from above. And yet, I would say that in each of these cases, for all this collaboration here, those guidelines that we impose, the way that we live, our corporate strategy, no exchange of funds, mutual benefit, clean managerial interfaces, all of those things have been abided by in our collaboration. And so each of these 4 astronauts brought with them experiments. Ukrainian, for example, showed us how to weld things in outer space. And the Israeli astronaut, Colonel Ilan Ramon, who was killed in STS-107, the space shuttle in Columbia, Pakistan, had a mid-east dust experiment that they were able to actually retrieve a lot of the data from the experiment before the end of the mission. One more word on types of cooperation that we do. A large number of the 600 or so international agreements that we have are for collaborations on ground networks that, because they're collecting in situ data from places around the ground, need to be distributed widely. And so an example of that would be AeroNet, where we have some photographers stationed in countries around the world that are constantly keeping track of the amount of aerosols in the atmosphere. And so that you can build global maps of aerosol distribution. And in each one of these things comes along, each one of these activities comes along with the soft touch, personal connections, friendships that can only be made when working together across the table on a scientific mission. Next, please. Okay, so now I've talked a little bit about the top level direction for NASA's outreach. And I've also talked about how we typically find our international partners. But there's a couple other things to think about out there. And it keeps coming back to what Vaughn said about about, it starts with the science. NASA's repository for some of the world's best scientists and engineers in their own highly esoteric fields. And these people have a tendency to get together with their counterparts around the world and establish the ground rules for how their fields work. And in many cases, these are fields that have real policy import. For example, one thing we care about deeply these days is space debris and characterizing the space environment, because orbital debris in space is a real problem for people in space and for lots of expensive satellites. So, just so happens, NASA has some of the country's best experts on orbital debris. They've got the best models, they know most about it, they've studied. And there are people like them in countries around the world. They get together in one of those, the collection of Alphabet groups, and they agree about how countries ought to approach the problem of making sure there's not too much orbital debris. Now, what's compelling for us about this is that it's all organic, it's all natural. The U.S. State Department didn't tell us to send this guy Nick Johnson out to meet with his partner so that we could establish how to worry about orbital debris. Yet he did it, and his group contacted the United Nations. And the United Nations set out a set of non-binding principles that pretty much everybody tries to abide by. And the same could be said of some of the other organizations out there, too. It's part of a way where scientists and engineers, you said the word lingua franca. It's how they help establish the scientific lingua franca that's accepted around the world. They help establish the scientific norms in these meetings. And we never raised a finger to do it, but we would never get that way. Next question. And so, speaking of things that we didn't intend to do, but are also pretty cool, NASA education. So NASA's Office of Education is funded currently at about $100 million a year, which makes it the fifth largest science, technology, engineering, math agency in the federal government. An education agency, I should say. Each one of NASA's programs and projects has a little bit of its money set aside to educate the public about what they're doing, what they need for it, and also to educate people in universities and students. And again, organically, no master plan was set up. People around NASA's 10 field centers put together all these different various ways to reach out to American students that just happened to be available and extremely compelling for cooperation by international partners. And so what you see up there is a young girl from Canada who's talking to an astronaut on the space station. You see a design for to allow Japanese middle school students to operate a camera on board the International Space Station. There is a photograph of students at a university in Bangladesh who built a robot miner to take part in competition in Huntsville. You have one there that I love, was featured on the earlier slide, but you've got a bunch of students in Bhopal, India, taking part in a NASA-led International Observe the Moon Night. I like the kids' t-shirts, right? You've got an artwork that was part of a NASA-sponsored international student art competition that was won by a young Russian man. And you have there's a news article there about train like an astronaut, a health related trying to get children and young people to engage in physical activity as though they were astronauts. And that's a news article from Brazil or virtual potential, which advertising it. So we've reached out and touched a large number of students around the world using these things that were never really intended to be international, but is still, I would argue, away from the Nazis or soft power. And then finally, just a word about outreach per se, just two things on outreach and social media. So NASA's outreach programs are definitely intentionally not focused on international. We have only a few resources for that. We really try to focus those on the United States. And yet, we do partner with some international organizations. And we partner with them mainly because they offer something really cool for us, and it doesn't really matter so much that they're international. But one of the most fun things that I've done in the last couple of years to sign an international agreement with a rodeo company to help put NASA on Angry Birds. And my 12-year-old really loves that. And that's, he actually interviewed me for a school project and got to interview one of your parents about what they do. And all that other stuff is irrelevant. But the Angry Birds thing, that caught on, right?
Yeah.
Lego. If you guys are techies, then you have to like Lego, right? We're also partnering with international companies to do exhibits in the U.S. and other places, and with the Mad Science Campus, a Canadian company that's expert on helping develop education materials. Since they're international, all that has come through our office. We're glad to do it. So finally, last thing I'll mention, then we can take some questions if we have time. Social media, you raised that. It's frankly something that hasn't been part of our world, like much of this. But it's what I found out that NASA actually does have a wide reach when it comes to international social media. And in fact, before we started this discussion, Matt and I were talking, and he mentioned that NASA has more Twitter followers than the State Department, which
and that's all of the State Department's 300 some odd Twitter accounts just combined. So just on their one main, you know, at NASA Twitter feed, is over 3.5 million followers. Impressive number to say the least, yeah, for a government agency.
Did you look at that? Did you look at that? Did you get the $3.5 million?
Yeah, it was just on the one NASA main Twitter feed.
Yeah. And so the only one with more apparently is the White House. So more followers is the White House. So I would argue, but I'm going to argue just a second when I close up, that by historically, right, by the fact that we were created in the middle of the Cold War, and by the nature of the things that we do, that are, let's face it, they are inspiring. You know? NASA has rewritten scientific textbooks every 5 years for the last generation. So that kind of thing gets noticed, and it can be used, you know, to make people want to seek out and learn more about our values. And so the other interesting thing here I've noticed about social media is there are some countries that are really sort of glommed onto NASA social media. For example, on Facebook, after the United States, the top five fan countries for NASA on Facebook are India. 19% of all total fans are from India, and Mexico and Brazil. And likewise, with our Twitter following, 12% of all the people who are following NASA on Twitter are from India. That may be a function of but this has been, I would argue that social media is a way that NASA will continue, unintentionally but inexorably, to reach out to people in other countries. And finally, just one chart to wrap it all up. So I got ahead of myself a little bit, but I think that NASA was sort of obliged to fill this role by the fact that we were created in such a political environment. And that what we do is something that is so evident, so in a way dramatic. I would like to convey the impression that from the very beginning, our partnerships and our public diplomacy, if you will, has been a matter of both a strategic choice, that people weigh above my pay grade, and practical necessity by scientists who are just trying to get the best job done for the buck. I'd also try to leave you with the idea that while NASA is we're a mission-driven, science and technology-focused agency. Everything we do is for the benefit of our missions. So our cooperation has been directed both to meet these objectives, and it's also sort of grown up from grassroots. So all the social media, all the international education, the outreach, the meetings of experts to sort of set the lingua franca in the field, all of those things take place in an agency that's just trying to get done. Traditional cooperation, the kind of thing that my office spends its time doing, is an important part of all that. International agreements for space missions are great, but the other stuff is really important too. That's something that we probably don't put enough time into thinking about, and I would love to have your suggestions for how to think about that. We communicate, like I said, with different publics around the world. Students, ordinary people, to experts, and we help them understand, value, and even emulate our vision of ideas. And I think that's the definition of what it is. So, thanks. Great.
personally learned quite a bit from them. I mean, I don't think many of us always think about how many cooperative efforts we have, over 4,000 over the last number of years, 600 currently. It's an incredible number. One sort of nagging question that's in my head, this is sort of a question for both of you, is opportunities with China. You know, we've talked about how the Soviet Union was our adversary at the time, and a lot of people view China, especially on the technology front, as being an adversarial nation. So what is NASA doing to address some opportunities with China, or what other opportunities might there be that are out there? Okay.
So I'm sure Glenn can probably expand on that quite a bit, probably to be a lot more than I can. Cooperation with China is something that NASA is prohibited by law.
Yeah. It's a great question, and it gets a little bit to some of the historical background. You know, even before the U.S. and China PRC had official relations established, the scientific communities were in fact having back and forth. And in fact, very early on, when Nixon went to China in his sort of groundbreaking visit, one of the things they were trying to do is figure out how do you move the relationship with China from just being focused on the geopolitical issues of containment of the Soviet Union to something that was a little bit broader. And so a key element of that was actually the science-technology cooperation as a way to sort of build some non-geopolitical links between the U.S. and China. By the end of the 70s, when the U.S. and China officially formalized relationships, the second thing signed after the statement of sort of recognition was that Jimmy Carter and Deng Xiaoping signed an agreement, a science-technology cooperation agreement. There's a great, and you know, I sort of don't like doing this too much, but I'll draw it first, and if anyone's got really good vision, then you can see it. But there's a great chart that basically shows one line going down like this and another line going up like this. And the inflection point is 1980. And this is number of students. The top line is the number of Iranian students studying in the United States. The bottom line is the number of Chinese students studying in the United States. And if you look at 1980, it turned out to be 1980 because there's a little bit of inertia in the system. In 1979, you have two big events. One, the U.S. formally recognizes Red China. And two, you have the Islamic Revolution in Iran and basically the cutoff of all relationships with the U.S. and Iran. One could make a fairly plausible argument that despite a lot of the challenges in the U.S.-China relationship, the ongoing back and forth, and especially more now, of key academic and scientific leaders from China has provided at least a little bit of understanding that takes place where maybe some of the higher political understandings are difficult. And you see the flip side with Iran. Many of the Iranian leaders now were actually trained in the United States, but that generation is now getting older, and you haven't filled it back up, and so there's actually, in many ways, a loss of understanding between the two sides. There's sort of these interesting statements going on in a whole other area of negotiation saying one of the biggest problems with any negotiation is you actually don't understand the person with whom you're negotiating with. And so that creates a lot of uncertainties. In the China-U.S. relationship, there is a lot more understanding, and no small part, now it's business and other things, but no small part that there have been a history of people going back and forth in academics. It's not without controversy, though. Because science and technology, as Ken was talking about with some of the other issues, gets very, very close to economic competitiveness. And so the challenge becomes, how do you ensure that from a national perspective, you're getting the most benefit? And a lot of it is in the basic research element. The basic research that provides greater knowledge actually provides a great field to do more in science. And the commercialization stuff, and this is true not only with China, but with many other countries, the commercializable stuff becomes more difficult to work on internationally. But the basic research, which underpins a lot of that economic growth, is actually benefits. It's sort of the law of large numbers. The more, the better.
Great. With that, I'd like to open it up to questions. A couple basic ground rules. One, raise your hand. And number two, let's ask a question and try to keep speeches down to a minute. In the back.
Hey, Nicholas, from the Sidonian TV. What NASA is doing about the threats such as asteroids you just mentioned, meteors, there is comet coming, and do you cooperate on this with other similar space agencies around the world, such as European Space Agency?
Sure, so the question was, what is NASA doing about the threat of near-earth objects or asteroids? And the answer is a lot. So NASA has been directed to make our best efforts to characterize the threat of the Earth, find all the asteroids in the command line. To that end, our budget for looking for asteroids was increased from $6 million to $1 million in 2012. And we're also continuing to, a lot of both basic and eventually flight research missions, into asteroids. And probably the biggest one coming up next would be the OSIRIS-REx mission, which is planned to be launched in the next few years. So that's an actual mission to get asteroids. We can't think of any international, but actually, yeah, we do. We have missions right now. The Dawn mission to asteroids is being conducted with cooperation from Italy and Germany. And while I don't know this, because but I would be 100% certain that the experts at NASA in the field of asteroids are collaborating with their partners, ESA and the other space agencies, to figure out the best approach to finding out why.
Will that also include the tracking of these near-Earth objects?
Yes.
Go ahead.
All right. I'm Ray Wallen at the Research Institution for Seismology at a U.S. University Consortium. You described how your mission compels you to engage in international cooperation. I could find it for engineering purposes to develop advanced instruments, or you mentioned the ground tracking stations. I was wondering whether or not the Earth Science mission itself sometimes pushed NASA towards international cooperation. Are there ways in which other countries want to observe the Earth where you find yourself working with them, driven by the scientific objectives?
Yeah, so absolutely. I'm sure Vaughn can probably answer this question way more eloquently than I can. But having, for a couple of years, well, it's working in our office, I was the director of the division that supported NASA's Earth Science Commission. And I know that the leaders of that organization have told me that international cooperation is critical because you need to get a look from a global look at the global system in different wavelengths and different parameters at the same time. So the only way that you can really get a sort of a synthetic vision of what's going on the Earth's systems at the same time is to do that with the widely distributed coalition partners. So, but I have a feeling that Vaughn could
really nail it. I don't know. I think you're giving me too much credit. I think, you know, we talk about these things all the time in the Earth Sciences. You know, the diversity and diversifying the numbers of actors gets you more samples, right? And gets you access to more samples. And I think that's, you know, especially as you deal with areas of sort of budget limitations, that's going to be, even having said, for these big field experiments. And then, you know, one that I was a little bit involved with was a NASA one, was on Safari 2000, which was looking at the Southern African aerosol regime. And that not only required sort of the traditional sort of NASA satellites and NASA planes, but a lot of the ground truthing. And ultimately, the ground truthing requires a multinational effort because you have to minimally, you actually have to have access to the sample sites. And so it gets involved in a lot of other things, but then you want to involve more scientists in this and ongoing monitoring and things like that. So.
That's absolutely right. I mean, and there are situations too, like, for example, both Japanese Space Agency and NASA have developed space missions to monitor carbon dioxide. NASA's OCO, the Orbital Carbon Observer mission, ended in failure. But at the same time, around the same time, JAXA had launched their GOSEC. And so we have, from before both missions launched, we had an agreement with JAXA where we would cross-validate each other's instruments so that, you know, just to make sure that the scientific readings from the two spacecraft would be compared. So we're moving forward with OCO2 to replace that. So that's one situation where, in an Earth science field, our partner's contribution complements what we're doing.
Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Pete Kelly from AAAS, report on program. And forgive me if I make a comment rather than a question, but try to build on what you offered.
Testing the rules.
So, part of what NASA is doing and contributing to in the field of Earth observations makes a very significant contribution to development goals. And I'm thinking, for example, example of famine early warning system. Forgive me if I step on somebody's toes, maybe that's a fellow sailor.
Nobody.
Or, for example, trying to seek out new water resources. And whether you can actually, specifically justify that in terms of new science or such as that, it does make a significant contribution to development. And so, maybe the question is, we tend to think of siloed government agencies, and you have to justify your programs in terms of how it's contributing to NASA's mission. But if there is a U.S. aid, good to be gained from that, can you help support the programs?
Wow, that's that one. That's a great question. Would it be possible to call up the
sure.
If you can go to slide 9? Funny that you mentioned it for the slides. So the bottom left-hand piece there is from Servier, which is a collaborative effort between NASA and USAID. It's led by USAID. And what it is a way of providing visualization from space-borne tools and assets, instruments and sensors and monitors in space, and to provide that to local decision makers in a way that combines it with information about what's going on in their own countries. So that is a picture that is available to a Servier node in Kenya. It overlays Earth science data from NASA satellites with models that have been developed locally, in this case to predict the spread of malaria. So that, yeah, absolutely. The answer to your question, yeah, we do that. And we're trying not to be stoked. Try to be very aware of the complementary, the value that we can have to other U.S. agencies.
I think we've got time for one more.
Hi, I'm Anna Dawson. I'm from the Center for International Private Enterprise and also an alum of the USC Masters of Public Diplomacy program with Matt here. My question deals with funding, federal funding, and especially federal funding of science programs or the lack thereof here in DC, and just how your office is dealing with the environment right now, justifying what you're doing to the greater goal of NASA, and just if you've seen any change in the last 20 years since you've been there, how are you doing?
Sure. So just when it comes to science, I'm sure this is another area where you can speak more eloquently than I can, but NASA's science mission directorate, which has four main areas, astrophysics, physics, Earth science, heliophysics, sun physics, planetary exploration, Earth science. Those four areas, priorities for all of those four scientific areas are set largely in coordination with the National Academies of Science, who do decadal surveys. They bring together large groups of what are recognized as the experts in the field. And they make it easy for us to argue on behalf of the priority of our missions and the amount of money that we're asking the administration to set aside for us by giving us an independent expert way of saying, yeah, this really is important. This really is what the field says. What our next steps are going to be. The answer to your question is I think we go to the experts. It's all about science.
Great, I think that about wraps it up for us. I'd like to thank you all for coming again. Feel free to check out our website, americansecurityproject.org. You'll find out we put a lot of product out for the size of an organization we are. We look at issues like climate change, national security, fusion power, terrorism, asymmetric operations. I encourage you to check it out when you get the chance. And I'd like to thank Mr. Bress and Dr. Tarikian for stepping in today.
Yeah.